Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, July 24th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. We'll have dispatches on the declaration by the West African state of Sierra Leone that the country is abolishing the death penalty. South Africa has restarted its COVID-19 vaccination program just 1 week after unrest occurred in two provinces in the Southern African state. Tanzania has received its first batch of 1 million doses of coronavirus vaccines after a long delay. And the United States has launched two airstrikes in Somalia over the last several days. In the second hour, we listen to a briefing from the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on the African Union's attempts to vaccinate the population against the pandemic. In the final hour, we analyze the recent events in South Africa, along with other issues impacting the continent and indeed the globe. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Kaka kama binadamu Siska oh siska Usini ponte dada Siska oh siska Siska fikiri dada Siska oh siska Yoka kama binadamu Siska oh siska Usini ponte dada Siska oh siska Siska fikiri dada Siska oh siska Yoka kama binadamu Yeah, boy, I'm a man, yeah, I'm a man. mobali lomi mobali ngana boi beni cholo titanga na zoto etwala ngano titanga na yebo na ipena meta ite mashanga ya bolingo telo bolingo lomi di bote ngana boi mobali mwana moko na boi nanga botutu beni cholo tole nanga mobali yo Linga na chova na dio
Thank you. Thank you.
ki moja, siti e moni ki kali, mekola ke ni umoja. Oh,
Tunaimba na shauri usikie, bila kusahau Chegar e analisar e
Yeah.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July 24, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And that was music from the Central and East Africa region, Orchestra Makassi with Morse Fanfan, along with selections from Remy Ongala. And right now we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. We'll start out looking at the current situation in the West African state of Sierra Leone. Lawmakers voted to abolish the death penalty yesterday, becoming the latest African country to move towards banning capital punishment. A majority of MPs voted by acclamation in favor of an amendment abolishing the death penalty, according to the Agence France-Presse journalist who was present in the chamber. Capital punishment will be replaced with life imprisonment or a minimum 30-year jail term for crimes such as murder or mutiny. No execution has taken place in the country since 1998, some 23 years ago, and death sentences have often been commuted. But Sierra Leone, which is still recovering after decades of civil war, has frequently come under fire from rights groups for keeping capital punishment on the books. In May, Deputy Justice Minister Umaru Napoleon Koroma announced that the government would move to ban the death penalty to uphold the fundamental human rights of Sierra Leoneans. Now, during a lively debate in the 146-member legislature on yesterday, Matthew Nauma, the parliamentary leader of the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, urged MPs to vote for abolition, saying, quote, "Please understand this is something we are sacrificing to meet international best practice," unquote. President Julius Maada Bio must still sign off on the abolition voted by Parliament before it becomes law. The vote in Sierra Leone comes as the use of capital punishment has been falling across the African continent and more countries have been outlawing the practice. Sierra Leone's 1991 constitution allows the use of the death penalty for aggravated robbery, murder, treason, and mutiny. However, the last executions in the country were carried out in 1998 when 24 military officers were put to death after a coup attempt the year before. Sierra Leone is a diamond-rich country. Nonetheless, there is poverty. It is a former British colony. It was impacted by a civil war between 1991 and 2002. According to estimates, 120,000 lives were lost. And in the Republic of South Africa, the COVID-19 vaccination campaign is regaining momentum after being disrupted earlier this month by a week of riots sparked by the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma. The country's acting health minister made this statement yesterday. At least 120 pharmacies, including 71 that were vaccination sites, were damaged and closed during the unrest in the KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng provinces, Acting Health Minister Mamoloko Okubaye Ngubane. Now, more than 47,000 vaccine doses were destroyed when the sites were ransacked, the acting health minister said. Also, minister said that, quote, "The social unrest has added to the complexity of our fight against the COVID-19 pandemic," saying that the violent nature of the protests unsettled the healthcare system as a whole. At least 337 people so far are noted as dying during the riots, including 213 deaths that police are investigating as possible murders, the government has stated. Major highways to Durban, one of Africa's busiest Indian Ocean ports, were also closed and barricaded, with more than 27 trucks burned in KwaZulu-Natal. Police also are investigating 132 cases of arson, including the burning of 11 warehouses and 8 factories. Property worth an estimated 20 billion rand, that's 1.37 billion U.S. dollars, was destroyed in KwaZulu-Natal. The violence was finally quelled when 25,000 army troops were deployed. South Africa is battling a resurgence of COVID-19. The country reported that 14,458 new infections and 433 deaths on Friday, according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Vaccination rates dropped as a result of the unrest, but have picked up pace. South Africa gave shots to more than 220,000 people per day just this last past week. It aims to increase the number to 300,000 inoculations each weekday next week. More than 6 million South Africans have received at least one shot, and 1.6 million are fully vaccinated with two jabs of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and one dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The country has now opened vaccinations to everybody above 35 years of age. The government has said it aims to have 67% of South Africa's 60 million people fully vaccinated by February of 2022. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In Tanzania, earlier today, the country received its first batch of 1 million Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines donated by the United States government. Tanzania had been among the few countries in Africa yet to receive vaccines or start inoculating its population, mainly because its former leader had claimed prayer had defeated COVID-19 in the East African state. The vaccines were received by Foreign Affairs Minister Liberata Mulamula and the U.S. Ambassador to Tanzania, Donald Wright, at the Julius Nyerere International Airport in the country's commercial capital of Dar es Salaam. Former Tanzanian President John Magufuli, who died in March, had refused to accept vaccines after he claimed 3 days of prayer had healed the country of the virus in June of 2020. Magufuli, who was 61 years old, was among the world's most prominent skeptics of COVID-19. Though his official cause of death was reported to be cardiac arrest, Magufuli's critics believe he died of COVID-19. Magufuli's deputy, Samai Suluhu Hassan, took over as president in line with the country's constitution and became the first woman president of the United Republic of Tanzania. Hassan has reversed Tanzania's practice of denying COVID-19 spread in the East African state. And finally, in the Horn of Africa for the second time this week, United States military forces yesterday conducted an airstrike against the Al-Shabaab extremist group. The earlier strike on Tuesday was the first in Somalia since President Joe Biden took office in January. In a brief statement, the Pentagon said the attack was conducted in support of the Somali partner forces and thus was allowed under existing congressional authorization for the use of military force. A Pentagon spokeswoman, Cindy King, said the airstrike was coordinated with the Somali government and took place in the Galmudug area in central Somalia in the vicinity of Akhted. She said further details would not be released to protect operational security. The United States removed most of its troops from Somalia in the final days of President Donald Trump's term, moving them to nearby countries where they remotely advise and assist the Somalian armed forces against Al-Shabaab, which is said to be an affiliate of the Al-Qaeda extremist network. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, in journals and research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to this program, the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for today, Saturday, July 24, 2021, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program. Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. I'm your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. That was the music of Mr. McKinley Morganfield, popularly known as Muddy Waters, with a tune entitled Please Have Mercy. And, of course, we're here every week with coverage of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, and we have been covering extensively the COVID-19 third wave on the African continent, and we're going to hear a briefing from the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, headed by Dr. John Nkengasong. This is a briefing from 2 days ago, talking about the status of COVID-19 vaccination rollouts across the country. Countries are starting to accelerate the deployment of the vaccines. Let's listen to the African CDC.
Dose, if it is a double dose regime, or 800 million doses if we use the single dose regime, of which there is only currently one supplier who does single dose, which is Johnson & Johnson. The African Union leadership were apprised of this challenge back in August. And that's when they set up the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Task Force. Our mission was to engage the donor community, including the White House. I spoke at the time with the White House President, under President Trump, and we continued those engagements after that. We have engaged with partners and nations around the world over our making sure they understand what our needs are. Our leadership decided in November, after engagements with the donor community, that our understanding by November was that COVAX could only do 20%, which would be a third of our target. Our clinicians, like Dr. John, made it absolutely clear that if we only achieved 20% vaccination of the African people, we would live permanently with this disease. And it would, we would now be dependent on a process of natural selection or natural herd immunity. So the African leaders decided that if that was the case, then they must go out and buy vaccines themselves. And it was not because we wanted to compete with COVAX. It was because we were told COVAX could not achieve. The donors were not willing to provide the funding for us to get to 60%. So we accepted that. The African leaders met with President Macron, representing the donors, in November and December, and pleaded with him to engage the other countries to meet us at least halfway, to push their commitments to at least 30% of our population, which would be half of our target. President Macron confirmed that they would indeed get to 30% as a minimum target. I'm not going to relitigate where we are. I'm going to focus now on what we as the African Union are doing. So our own target was to achieve enough vaccines for 400 million people. We engaged all the suppliers who were authorized by the WHO, including the Chinese and the Russian suppliers. We met with them all. And as I've pointed out before, the challenge has been the availability of vaccines, not the availability of money. By November, the African Union, the AVAT task force, had already secured $2 billion, equivalent to what the United States has put into COVAX. We had $2 billion by November. That money was provided by the Afri-Exim Bank, an African institution funded primarily by African countries, the largest single shareholders being Nigeria and Egypt. 10 finance ministers of the African Union members met and increased the capital of the African Union, of the Afri-Exim Bank, sorry, in order for it to have the capacity to finance direct vaccine acquisitions. I consider that to be one of the most important meetings in modern Africa. When African countries came together, we had all the finance ministers, all the health ministers, and we said we will buy vaccines, and we will buy them with our own money. And then the African Union itself, at its annual meeting in January, issued a resolution calling on the African member states, who are financiers of the Afreximbank Bank, to increase its capital base to enable it to fund. That resolution is available for anyone to observe. It shows our own determination to drive our own destiny. So we, having secured the funding, we engaged Johnson & Johnson. As I've explained to you before, the reason we engaged Johnson & Johnson was that they are the only one of the major suppliers who had an agreement to produce from the African continent. It was clear to us by January that vaccine nationalism was being played out over production assets. That is where it is played out. The countries with the production assets control the release of vaccines. So we at least could rely on one production asset, which was on African soil, which was the Aspen facility, which the ambassador rightly pointed out they are supporting. But the Aspen facility was already at a position to deliver 300 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So President Ramaphosa, as the African Union chair, led the negotiations. Myself and John Kengaston here, we were members of the committee that negotiated with Johnson & Johnson. And Johnson & Johnson, like all the suppliers, wanted upfront payment, a bank guarantee. We provided all that to the level of $2 billion. And our order with them is made up of two parts. It is a 400 million dose order, which when delivered by September next year, starting next week, all shipments begin next week. And when we have completed the delivery of the Johnson & Johnson shipments, we will have achieved 30%. Which is 50% of the set target, with the hope that the donor community, now led by the United States, will meet us halfway for the other 30%. So really the good news from my side is this. Commencing next week, we will ship 6 million doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccines for the July-August period. These are single-dose vaccines. They'll go to 27 African countries that have already paid for their vaccines. An additional 18 African countries are in the process of finalizing their loans from the World Bank. We're meeting again with the World Bank tomorrow. They have committed to fully funding those countries that need funding support. So we expect that by the end of August, 45 countries will have completed their first shipments. Thereafter, Johnson & Johnson will be shipping from the Aspen facility on average 10 million single dose vaccines, 10 million September, 10 million October, 10 million December. In January, we move to 20 million a month, and we will continue exponentially increasing that until all 400 million doses have been delivered by September next year. So we have, as AVAT, we have institutionalized ourselves. the union has authorized us to turn Avat into a standing permanent structure for purchasing of vaccine now and in future. The Avat is now called the Africa Vaccine Acquisition Trust. That was the special purpose vehicle which was set up to fund the purchase of vaccines. So it now, we are now trustees of that with members of our leadership. The Avat vehicle is the vehicle for vaccine acquisition partnerships. That's why in statements now you see Avat rather than Africa CDC. Africa CDC is a member of Avat. So the Avat vehicle continues to look for opportunities to acquire additional vaccines. Let me conclude by talking about Pfizer and the production side. As I've pointed out before, in my capacity as the African Union Special Envoy, I am a volunteer. I'm a volunteer businessman. I'm not in this industry. I was invited by President Ramaphosa to do this job because I did the same job during the Ebola crisis. So I have spent the last year working full-time on this. I advise my presidents that we need production capacity now. If we don't have production capacity, if this crisis comes back, we'll be in the same position. In the last few weeks, President Ramaphosa and the Avat team have been engaged with the European governments about the delivery of vaccine substance rather than vaccine donations. We want substance to the factories. So the Europeans have agreed to ship vaccine substance to our facility in Aspen. So the facility in Aspen, which has previously taken drug substance from the United States, emergent facility, is producing these vaccines that I have mentioned from vaccine substance delivered from Europe. This is a result of very successful negotiations between President Ramaphosa and his counterpart, President Ursula von der Leyen. And we really appreciate this partnership from Europe because it is fundamental to our approach, which is we want to ramp up production on the continent, which means we want drug substance to also begin to flow. We won't solve this permanently through donations. We have to have a sustainable approach to production. We were in negotiations with Pfizer. We had a lot of difficulty negotiating with Pfizer. I tell you straight as it is, we had a lot of difficulties. Finally, we called off the negotiations. The chairman of Pfizer called me, Albert Bola. I commend him. He called me. He said, "I'm sorry, this worked out this way. How do we fix this?" He's the only one of the pharma chairmen who did that. He said, "I want to fix this. Help me understand what the problem is." So we discussed it extensively. I informed President Ramaphosa, who also got engaged. He came back to us and he said, "I'm going to the White House to see how we can do this." So we feel very much that the decision of the United States to work with Pfizer to purchase vaccines is something that is a game changer in all this. Okay. Further, I told Albert Bola that they must produce from the African continent. He called me and he said, "My board has approved your proposal that we produce from the African continent. So they will be producing 100 million doses a year from the BioVac facility, another vaccine producer based in Africa. But we are not stopping there. We want to make clear to all suppliers, as I have told them, that if you want a long-term future with us now, you produce from Africa. We don't mind. You can, if you want land, we'll give you. If you want to own everything 100%, we don't mind. Just produce from the African continent. Because when we got into trouble this time, it was because there was no production from the African continent. The countries that had production, whether it was India, the United States, Europe, Japan, they all restricted shipments. So now we are pleased to see that Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer have made commitments to ship from Africa. We, however, want to make it clear that we prefer that they license producers in Africa rather than to produce under contract, because we want to be treated the same way as they produce in India. Okay? If they can produce under license in India, they should be able to produce under license in Africa, but we need these to be purely commercial negotiations between the parties. I'm not involved in those things. So to summarize, the African Union has purchased 400 million doses. 220 million has been paid for. 180 million is an option we trigger in September if the orders have come in. I'm pleased to say that African countries have ordered and placed pre-orders in excess of 400 million doses. This demonstrates that they are willing to pay for their vaccines. They are willing to stand together, and they are willing to fight this disease. So and for that, we are extremely grateful. We have entered into an agreement with UNICEF to act as our distributor. They did not do the purchasing on our behalf. They act as the distributors. So as I'm speaking now, UNICEF have begun to receive instructions from us to collect doses from the factory at Aspen and to begin to move them to the various countries. I will stop there to allow us to have a discussion. Unfortunately, today I won't be able to stay throughout, but I am pleased to pick up on these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was Mr. Clive Matiwa, who is the AU Special Envoy on COVID-19 and the coordinator of the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Force, which, as he said, has now been transformed into a trust. Very significant developments there. Thank you very much. Now we move on to your questions. And the very first person to ask a question was Elana Gordon, who is with The World from GBH and PRX, a national radio show in the United States. And she says, my question is, and this is to Dr. John, Niger has not experienced many cases of COVID-19. Is this a unique outlier? And if so, what can the rest of the region learn about the virus from this situation? Do you think that it is possible that the country will be able to avoid an outbreak altogether, that the situation is uniquely hostile to COVID-19, or do you worry about cases growing there? And this is in reference to Niger. Dr. John, that is for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Wayne, and the reporter. I just want to say that we have to take a very close look at Niger and other countries across the continent that find themselves in a similar situation to understand what is going on in the country and what are some of the factors that might be leading to that. Is it a natural process, meaning that are there any factors that are making the situation look stable, or is it under reporting of the cases? There are so many things that we need to look at from epidemiologically and make sure that science guides us into drawing the conclusions there. I think that is one. The second thing is that it's a general warning I've had for our continent from the beginning. This is a very treacherous virus. I'm a virologist for over 3 decades, and viruses will tend to give you that false sense of complacency, seed itself into the population, and then explode. We've seen this in across the continent, in Liberia, in many countries, that even Uganda. Uganda started off with very low numbers, and then, of course, you see where it is now. I mean, Namibia and others. So again, a very cautionary word here to any country that is seeing low numbers. Let's use the full power of epidemiology to understand what is going on before we jump into conclusions. But be careful. This is a dangerous virus. It's a treacherous virus, and we just don't know how it would pan out. It may be delayed epidemic or outbreaks in Niger, but at this point, it's very dangerous to conclude that they have an unusual situation.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, I'm going to ask you, as we've done when we are in a tight corner because of time, please stick to one priority question per person so that we can accommodate as many as we can. All right, now let me welcome Gabrielle Steinhauser from the Wall Street Journal. Gabrielle, good morning. Please go ahead with your question.
Thank you so much. Good morning. What is the realistic target for African countries to achieve in terms of their population being vaccinated by the end of this year, given the supply agreements and promises currently in place? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Who is your question targeted at?
I think it's for Dr. John.
Dr. John?
A realistic target, I mean, Gabriela, is that we are aiming to immunize, and we still remain focused with that, that we should be able to use science to drive our targets, which is we need to get at least 25% to 30% of our population vaccinated if we have to fight this pandemic and get make sure that it doesn't get into endemicity. We are still very focused on that. If we listen to the numbers that Mr. Masiwa put out there, and we also factor in the bilateral donations that Ambassador Lapen mentioned and other projections that we are having, that it is very possible that we can achieve that target if the vaccines truly start rolling out in August and scale up in September and November. It is very, very doable there. I think, however, we have to be very careful that as vaccines are beginning to roll out on the continent, we also have the capacity to increase our ability to roll out the vaccination. We've always maintained that vaccines plus vaccination equals life safe and economy safe. So again, we remain very optimistic that we will be able to, if we have a predictable supply of vaccines, we should be able to roll them out and get to at least 30% of our population by the end of the year.
John and I work together, so sometimes we're like twins, so we can contradict each other. He's given you a dimension to this. I'm going to give you the numbers. The most guaranteed position that we have right now on delivery of vaccines is what I just gave you, the AVAX delivery. Okay, we've paid for it. The production is there. We have 45 million doses to be delivered by the end of December. Okay, that's 45 million people. Okay, so you can run that number, 45 million. Okay, the U.S. government has kindly committed around 25 million doses at present. Okay, and I have them all in, I have everything in my head. Okay, roughly 15 million of that are double dose. Okay, the other 10 are Johnson & Johnson at the present moment. So you can run the number, 7.5 million plus 10, that's 17.5 million plus 45 million. If the United States, and I have no reason to believe they will not achieve this, they are the United States, we don't know what portion of the 500 global announced is for Africa. But let us assume for a moment that it's 50%. Ambassador, we want at least 50%. And you know that I have been saying that. If so, let's assume that the U.S. government gives us 50% of the 500. That's 250 million doses, 125 million people vaccinated. That's not going to happen between September and December. Impossible. Okay? And even if it did, the absorptive capacity of a Pfizer vaccine is much harder. It's going to be to more limited countries because we don't have in place the full cold storage infrastructure for the ultra cold chain required around Pfizer. But let's assume that that 250 million is delivered over 12 months to September, to September next year. Okay. Maybe that's circa another 20 million a month. Okay. So certainly the U.S. commitment is 50-50 where we are as Africa. Okay. We love that. It's a 50-50 partnership. We've been meeting with the U.S. Diplomats, John and I, and some of our colleagues. We meet with your people almost every week. We talk about the distribution, the deliveries, and so forth. It's the best part of the partnership. Now, COVAX, we haven't written them off. Okay? So let's look at what COVAX can deliver. They were supposed to deliver 700 by the end of the year. They have delivered, give or take, 60 million doses. Okay? Double dose regime around the AstraZeneca COVIShield vaccine from India. Now, everything now depends on India. Does India open up to deliver, to allow the Indian manufacturers to release the vaccines? Because COVAX can only rely on the Indian supplies, and those are being politically restricted. It's not the manufacturers, but it's political. Now, India's position is not different from other countries, so I'm not going to bash India on the head. We've been meeting with Indian diplomats, Azabat, pushing them to say, please release the vaccines to COVAX that COVAX has paid for so that we can get our distribution. Okay? Because again, contrary to what people may think, we meet regularly with COVAX. There's no day that goes by without some communication between us and the COVAX guys. We're critical of things that have been done, but we work with them, okay? You can criticize me if I go wrong, but we can work together, okay? And we work very well with Dr. Seth Berkley, explaining to him our sources of frustration and the problems that we see. And we go out to try even to force the hand on them. So the position is very clear. There's no possibility that we can vaccinate 60% of the African population by December. Impossible. Not as things stand. Okay? Could we achieve it by September next year, August, September next year, with the current availability of vaccines? That's our best hope. We can only speak from the African Union perspective that whether or not donors come to the table, we will do our very best with our meager resources to take our continent to 60%. But we appreciate the extraordinary commitment of the Biden-Harris administration. Sorry for the longevity, but I hope that covers a bit of ground for some of you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now we move on with our questions, and the next one is for the ambassador, and it is coming from Kara Anna of the Associated Press. So Kara says, what is the country-by-country breakdown for the 25 million vaccine doses that the United States is donating to the African Union, and how many of the 500 million Pfizer doses committed by the U.S. are going to African countries?
Thanks very much. So as Strad said, on the 500 million, there is not yet a determination. We know that is of huge interest. And frankly, I think in terms of both your questions, we understand the huge interest, the bottom line being when will a particular country or community get vaccinated. So on the 500 million, I don't yet have an answer. We're still working that through. On the issue of allocations more broadly for this first 25 million, we did the allocation in close partnership with Strive, with Dr. John, and also with national government. We looked at criteria around the epidemic, around national programs, what vaccines did they already have, what were they using, what was the level of vulnerability. And on the basis of inputs like that, reached a proposed allocation that was then offered. Countries then took up the offer. And in the vast, vast majority of countries, indeed, they took up the offer that the U.S. through AVAT and African Union and Africa CDC put on the table. And now, as I say, they are rolling out. The specific numbers, I don't have all of them at this point. Those, we have the numbers, which we're happy to provide you, for the deliveries that have already been made. And in the other cases, I just basically, as deliveries happen, I don't want to give you the wrong number. We've seen a lot of bad information already in this pandemic, so that's something I don't want to do. But we're happy, as deliveries get made, to make specific information available. And certainly our embassies across the continent are doing that in partnership with national governments and civil society so that the people have visibility on the donations that were being made. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We move on now to Paul Adepoju. And Paul says, for Dr. John, I'd like to know whether the continent is now testing enough to have more accurate data on the state of the pandemic in Africa, and also what is the latest update on vaccination in Tanzania?
So, Paul, the continent is not testing enough. I mean, as you heard me stated today, our test positivity ratio is around 9. So that is the test per case. I mean, I would like to see it above 10. Okay, that is clearly still a shortage there, and we continue to be encouraged that, as I indicated earlier, that there was an increase this week, but we like to see a steady increase over time because the foundation for fighting any infectious disease is good testing, and we have to test at scale all the time and maintain that level of testing. So we are not yet there, I think, but we are very encouraged with the progress that has been achieved so far. For Tanzania, again, as I said, there are three countries, Tanzania, Burundi, and Eritrea, that we still don't have vaccination started there. So that is the current situation with respect to those countries there. So we encourage all countries to engage in with us. We are here to offer support, technical advice, and technical assistance to countries that are in need of such assistance to start their vaccination program. But I must say that Tanzania has also joined AVAT and acquired vaccines. I think that is very, very good news, and a lot of vaccines for that matter. So we are seeing, it is fair to say that we've now seen a significant shift in Tanzania's position. So we are here to support them as much as possible, both through AVAD and also through the vaccination program.
Thank you very much, John. We move on now to Coletta Wanjohi, who is with the FSN. She had two questions, one of which has already been answered, and that was on the status of vaccination supply on the continent. That has been dealt with. But her second question is, we see that COVID-19 vaccine producers seeking hubs in African countries, for example, Pfizer in South Africa. What are the dangers of Africa not benefiting from knowledge transfer and just remaining as a production point? Are there any measures to ensure that this doesn't happen? Perhaps let me give that to Mr. Masiwa.
Yeah, just to pivot, first of all, just something from what my colleague John Kengasong has said. Part of approaching this as the African Union, AVAT and Africa CDC are organs of the African Union. The three are not separate. So we work together as one. We engage member states to establish where there is a problem. We are pleased to say that Tanzania has become one of the biggest buyers of AVAT vaccines. They have placed a massive order. And we are helping them, working with the World Bank, to get them up to speed. We currently have only two countries, so I'm not here to name and shame. There are only two countries over which we are still facing difficulties to get them to acquire vaccines, either because everybody must be vaccinated that is willing to be vaccinated for us to achieve our 60%. And by the way, on the anti-vaxxer side, we've done polling through the Africa CDC, and we have established that more than 70% of African people are willing to take a vaccine if it is made readily available. So let us not be drowned by the loud voices of the minority here. Most African people will take vaccines if they are offered. So to your final question, sorry I lost that. Remind me again, what was that last piece?
She was asking any measures to ensure that Africa does not remain just a production point without any knowledge transfer of how to make our own vaccines.
Yes, you know, that's a good question, but let me put it this way. Aspen Pharmaceutical is one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the Southern Hemisphere. It's a big company. It may not, vaccines is just one product. They're a South African company with manufacturing facilities across several African countries. These are well-established African businesses, and they are run by Africans. So to the extent that they have entered into this agreement, they have done so knowing what technology transfer they need to carry out their work. Similarly, the Dakar Institute in Senegal is another major hub that we are pushing. They're already able to deliver 60 million doses of vaccines. So the real challenge for us on the vaccine side, if I may say this, on the production side, lest we find ourselves running through rabbit warrens, the most important thing on vaccine production is demand. Demand. It is not the ability to produce a vaccine. This we can do pretty quickly. There are industrialists in Africa who would be happy to do it. Aliko Dangote said to us, tell us, I will set up a facility in Nigeria tomorrow and we can produce vaccines. Because that isn't the issue here. The issue is demand. The ability to, if you set up the facility, will there be demand for the vaccines? Right now, the global architecture around how vaccines are purchased would mean that we would not be able to necessarily get orders to those companies. Suppliers in India, such as Serum Institute, they get 94% of the orders for African vaccines from Gavi and UNICEF. And we've met with Gavi and UNICEF, and we said, no, this must stop. You've shipped 6 million production jobs to India. We love India, but we love to produce these vaccines here. So what is critical here is for UNICEF, who buys vaccines using donor funding, Gavi, who buy vaccines using donor funding, to place orders with African manufacturers. The manufacturers are here. I can give you a list if you need it, who can ramp up very, very quickly to meet our vaccine production requirements. Yeah, that's the real issue. And by the way, we've met with UNICEF. We met them this week, and I gave them a very simple challenge. You place $200 million order with an African producer, and we'll match you. We're working on that together. So it doesn't. So if Pfizer produces in South Africa, then we must purchase those vaccines. Who's going to purchase them? UNICEF and AVAT are the only vehicles by which you can purchase, unless they're going to go around country by country trying to find orders. Okay, so we've got to fix the demand side. Without a market, market is there, yes, but demand and money is skewed towards buying vaccines in India and bringing them to Africa. That's what we need to deal with. The technology piece is pretty straightforward.
All right. Thank you very much for that explanation. For Dr. John is a question coming up from Rhoda Odhiambo of the BBC. She says, right now, governments are pushing for vaccine production, but what about regulation? Where is the Africa Medicines Agency in all these plans that are being made? And what will happen if it will not be able to get enough countries to ratify the treaty to bring it into existence?
So thank you, Rhoda. Let's start with the good news that we now have enough countries that have ratified the Africa Medicines Agency. That is very good news. I think that has really not been talked about enough. So that is extremely helpful. Second thing is that we don't need to get AMA or the African Medicine Agency up and running before you do that. You can use individual country capacity. South Africa and other countries have that capacity to produce authoritative, regulatory, sound opinion to get this vaccine production going. It will be a process. Let's be very clear that building an institution takes time. I mean, the fact that the AMA now has the required signatures for ratification doesn't mean that in the next 1 month or 2 months you get an institution up and running. It will take some time to get it up and running. At the same time, we have national structures that we can rely on. I think that is very important. So I'm very encouraged by the word you heard Stripe describe as the movement in Africa, whether in South Africa, Morocco, Egypt, Algeria, Senegal, and potential Rwanda. Sorry?
Ghana and Rwanda.
Ghana and Nigeria. Very, very encouraged. I think that is just what a kind of movement that we wanted to see on the continent. Now we have to fix the demand side and also fix the regulatory side. That's why the African initiative, which was launched by President Félix Tshisekedi as the chair of the African Union, called the Partnership for African Vaccine Manufacturing, is so important. And this afternoon, we'll be launching that platform with key stakeholders there. So I think a lot of good progress with respect to vaccine manufacturing on the continent. Let me just conclude by saying I remain very optimistic that the way and manner in which we'll fight the next pandemic, which obviously will be a next pandemic, will be very different from the way we are fighting this pandemic because of all these developments that we are discussing here and that are taking place on the continent.
Thank you very much, John.
And John, and it's John just to reinforce this so that people don't get hung up. There's nothing that we need to do with AMA that would delay us on the regulatory front. These are our countries. These are regulations. Give you an example. People said, oh, you don't have armor yet. So how are you going to issue emergency use authorizations? Dr. John pulled together a committee made up of all the regulators in Africa, and now we issue emergency use authorizations for the whole continent. So we can get through our own regulations. So this is not going to be a barrier. But yes, we will have armor up and running.
All right, thank you. We had been given an extra 15 minutes. So perhaps this will be the last question before we then go into the summary. And it is coming from Duncan Miriri, who has the question, China has rejected a second study on the origins of the virus. What is your reaction, please? Dr. John.
So I think WHO is working closely with a team of scientists to address that. And I think we should let WHO guide the process. Dr. Tedros was very clear in his comments last week about the need for more cooperation with China. I think let's let the scientists, the panel of scientists, get to the bottom of that. Knowing the origin of this, the pandemic is very important because this is the only way that will enable us to prepare for and fight the next pandemic. And we all have to rally behind the WHO so that they have the right authority, the empowerment to get to the bottom of this. So let's stay patient and give the scientists, the WHO, the chance to, and the panel that are working on the chance to continue to investigate and go to the root cause of this pandemic, which is a huge the pandemic in the last 100 years for all of us. If we don't know the origin, we don't know how it originated, it will become difficult to plan for and enable ourselves to fight the next pandemic.
Thank you very much, Dr. John. It's now time for us to go into the summaries, but before that, let me just say that a number of colleagues had asked a second or third questions, and we have not been able to go through all of them because time was not on our side. So for those colleagues, I wish to advise that perhaps you can hold on to the questions until the next briefing, or you can send them in to Nekeron on that WhatsApp number. And that number is +251 94 550 2310. That's +251 94 550 2310. So let's take the next 5 minutes to conclude with summaries. Let me start with Mr. Strive Masiwa. In a minute or so, please give us the main points that you'd like people to remember from today.
We start shipping vaccines that have been purchased from Johnson & Johnson from next week. It will be a monthly, weekly, it will be a weekly process of shipment to countries. We are setting in place the cycles. We have agreed distribution lists with UNICEF. Countries have been notified, and we are very excited that the first shipments will start to reach countries by the end of next week, and we will continue on until our program to deliver 400 million doses is in place. Funding around the vaccines on our side is looking very good. The demand from the countries is in excess of what we have purchased, and we are looking for ways to improve on that. We absolutely welcome the decision by Pfizer to join Johnson & Johnson to produce on the African soil in partnership with African companies. We are looking to see other announcements very shortly from manufacturers from other parts of the world who are working with companies in Egypt, in Senegal, in Rwanda, in Ghana, and in a number of other African countries. These are initiatives that we are supporting. We have worked closely with the U.S. government on the allocation of vaccines. We gave them the formula on which to allocate vaccines, and they were respectful of our formula. They are using exactly the same formula that we use for member states. We have informed the member states, and the American government also has a direct bilateral allocation for which we are not a part. But they have published this on their website. It's there. You can go to the White House website and see it for yourself. We continue to urge the donor community to come to meet their pledges because we expected a lot more funding to be made available to COVAX than where we are at present. We are very, very far away from achieving vaccination of our population by December. And we will need considerable greater effort from the donor community to meet their side of the commitments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Before we move on to the ambassador, let me request both our panelists to please provide their talking points to our team so that it can be shared. We do share the talking points from Dr. John every week. And so we have requests here from colleagues in the media for the talking points of both the ambassador and Mr. Masiwa. All right, now let's move on to Ambassador Le Pen for your main talking points from today, the things that you want people to remember. Over to you, Ambassador.
Thank you very much. I'll pick up in union on the allocation. I think it is a hugely important point. It is unique in how we are structuring designation and allocation for shared doses. It reflects our appreciation for the work that the African Union has done, as Strive described. It also reflects our appreciation for the US-AU partnership. And so the 25 million of the shared doses have begun to roll out by the end of this week to about 10 countries. They'll continue to roll over the next few weeks. And then in August, when the AU purchase, when the RVAT purchase J&J doses begins, we hope to begin also distribution on the purchased Pfizer from the US. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We go over to Dr. John for your headline points, please.
No, wonderful. I think we are here today witnessing the power of partnerships, and that will enable us to achieve the target of immunizing at least 60% of our population by the end of next year, but make sure that we remain aspirational, that by December we should strive to immunize at least up to about 25% of our population. If we do, if we continue this, the power of partnerships there with AVAC, with the bilaterals from the U.S. government and other bilaterals, with COVAX, hopefully remain hopeful that they should be able to deliver that. Well, I say this because, I mean, and I believe in this because we are dealing with a pandemic, and if we do not want to run into endemicity, we need to strive and be bold in trying to get this target there. That way, we can rest assured that we do not live with this virus past 2022 and 23. So I really like to that we take what the good news that Strive mentioned today into and really make sure that the world understands the remarkable progress that is being made through the Africans' own leadership efforts there. And the power of partnership speaks to this, the AVAT, the whole concept of AVAT, where leaders like Professor Benedict Orama from the Afri-Exim Bank, leaders like Dr. Vera Songwe from the Executive Secretary of the UN Economic Commission for Africa, strive coordinating all of it. That is the power of the partnership that I'm referring to, that the solutions are not coming from the public health experts. We are coming from the partnership, very, very broad partnership there, and the political leadership and partnership from President Cyril Ramaphosa. I think that is one. and the bilateral partnerships like the one we are here discussing with the U.S. government and others, we encourage the Europeans and others to join that. That is the power of partnership and cooperation that will enable us to win this battle against COVID-19. That has enabled us to acquire vaccines, but I would also want to see this power of partnership play in the vaccination realm. That way we acquire vaccines and the vaccines get into the arms of people. This partnership cannot end only at the level of acquisition of vaccines, but we'd like to see the power of partnership expanded into the vaccination program. That way we can join forces with the MasterCard Foundation efforts to get the vaccines into arms. And lastly is that vaccines are not the magic bullet as we speak today. It will take time to get a vaccine into people's arms. So public health measures must be practiced. And we need everybody to cooperate. We need the political leadership of the continent to continue to exercise that leadership, avoid political rallies, avoid any opportunities that will offer a transmission opportunity for the virus. And I think we need that they continue to support the wearing of masking in public places as much as possible, subsidize that. That is, masks for now are our best vaccines for the continent. So let's not let our guard down and let's continue to make sure that we do all three things together. That is, implement public health measures, roll out vaccinations, and roll out vaccination acquisition. I think that is the takeaway message from Africa CDC today, but let's celebrate the power of partnership that that is being expressed this morning through this platform.
Thank you very much, Dr. John of the Africa CDC. And let me just thank all our panelists one by one for this very rich content that we've had this morning. So let me thank Mr. Strive Masiwa, who is the African Union Special Envoy on COVID-19 and is also the coordinator of the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Force. Thank you to Her Excellency Jesse LaPen, the head of the United States Mission to the African Union. And finally to Dr. John Nkengasong, our host, who is the director of the Africa CDC. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us. And thank you very much to the team behind the scenes for making all this possible. Let's meet again next week on Thursday at the same time. Bye-bye for now.
Welcome back. And that was a report and a briefing from the African Centers for Disease Control. Also the African Union Task Force on Vaccinations, and of course they gave a thorough evaluation and projection of the African Union member states in regard to acquisition, access, and also implementation of the vaccination programs to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 on the African continent. In some countries, the rates of transmission are increasing exponentially. South Africa, of course, as we've talked about, has the highest rate of infection on the African continent. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and today is Saturday, July 24th, 2021, and we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and we'll take a break. We'll be back with another segment of our program.
Walk away. time. I need my space. Maybe someday, in another time or place, just turn around. I don't need this, not right now.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July 24th, 2021, and that was the voice of Detroit's own Anita Baker with the tune entitled, How Does It Feel? And right now we want to move into a Africa Live CGTN segment on assessing and analyzing the recent unrest in the Republic of South Africa. We'll listen in right now.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
South Africa is facing a scale of social unrest not seen in nearly three decades. There have been days of protests and looting across the country. It was all sparked by the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma. Protests began in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal but spread to Gauteng province. Issues of anger over poverty as well as inequality, which remained despite apartheid ending 27 years ago, came to the forefront. The country's economic hub, Johannesburg, was rocked by the violence. This all comes as the COVID-19 pandemic has hit South Africa's economy hard. For over a year now, strict measures aimed at curbing the spread of the virus have resulted in social and economic restrictions. This frustration led to businesses being looted and burnt. Hundreds of people have lost their lives. Amidst all this, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa says the violence and looting was planned and coordinated. In an effort to restore order, he has deployed 25,000 troops to the streets of Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal provinces. On this week's show of Talk Africa, we are going beyond the latest updates to look at the underlying causes for the unrest and unpack how the government is tackling this crisis. I'm Beatrice Marshall. Welcome to Talk Africa. The current violence in South Africa has left President Cyril Ramaphosa facing both economic and political challenges. A week after protests started, he visited the affected sites and says the economy has been hard hit. CGTN's Aster Tal gives us an overview of the situation.
When President Cyril Ramaphosa first came into office, he pledged to tackle corruption and improve the country's economy. The widespread unrest following the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma has put both pledges to the test.
Property has been vandalized and destroyed. Shops have been looted. Law-abiding citizens have been threatened and intimidated. Workers are scared that they may not be able to return to work.
The protest started in the eastern province of KwaZulu-Natal. Zuma is a native of the province where he currently resides. Since then, stores and malls have been looted. Trade routes have been disrupted, including the N3, a major highway linking to Durban's biggest port. The country's COVID-19 immunizations have also been hit hard. COVID-19 vaccination sites in Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal provinces were forced to close following attacks. Jacob Zuma has since started a 15-month jail term for contempt of court. The Constitutional Court handed the sentence after Zuma failed to appear before the Zondo Commission to answer questions. Addressing the court virtually, his counsel pushed for the court to rescind Zuma's jail term. Police have said protests intensified as Zuma challenged his 15-month sentence. Indeed, there is division both in the streets of South Africa and in the ruling African National Congress Party. Zuma still enjoys support from his former party, including that of Ace Magashule, who is currently suspended from his role as a Secretary General of the ANC as he faces a criminal case stemming from corruption charges. For his part, President Ramaphosa has pushed against what he labeled as opportunistic acts.
Some have characterized these actions as a form of political protest. This violence may indeed have its roots in the pronouncements and activities of individuals with a political purpose and in expressions of frustration and anger. At the beginning of this unrest, there may have been some people who sought to agitate for violence and disorder along ethnic lines. We know that the majority of our people have, out of principle, refused to be mobilized along these ethnic lines. However, what we are witnessing now are opportunistic acts of criminality with groups of people instigating chaos merely as a cover for looting and theft.
The Constitutional Court will now rule on whether to rescind Zuma's jail term. Asatal, CGTN.
Well, joining us now on our panel today, in Johannesburg, Tembisa Fakude. He's a senior research fellow and director of the Africa-Asia Dialogues in Johannesburg, joining us via Zoom. Crown Prince Adil Ntshabelane, the Royal Prince of the Royal Rau Ntshabelane Tribal Authority in Limpopo, South Africa. Also in Johannesburg via Zoom, Mr. Kofi Kwaku, the Africa Analyst and Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. Thank you all, gentlemen, for joining in this discussion. Tembisa, if I may start off with you. South Africa's police have been battling looters and protesters for a while now. The crisis, as many say, has exposed deeper issues within South African society. What would you say is the cause of the unrest, and who exactly is to blame for this?
The current narrative is that the violence was triggered by the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma, and that's the narrative that we currently have from all and sundry in South Africa. But we also know that the violence started amidst a very volatile social-political situation or an environment in South Africa, with the COVID-19 continuing to destroy lives in South Africa. The level of unemployment has, as a result, increased. Poverty has increased. So there are all those anxieties. And when President Jacob Zuma, who had an organized grouping behind him which called for his release after he was arrested, that triggered the current violence that we are, you know, some parts of South Africa are still experiencing. But over and above that, I think there are a lot of other underlying political problems, particularly within the governing ANC. And people have said that the factions within the ANC that disagree with the current political trajectory that has been embraced by President Cyril Ramaphosa is also to be blamed for the violence we witnessed last week.
Prince Ntshabelane, what do you think are the reasons? Is this more than just a spontaneous triggering of anger? Is it a political problem, an economic problem? What is your view?
The current riots and uprisings in South Africa is more than anything else an indication. It started off as a political problem whereby masses took onto the streets, one, to demand the unconditional release of former President Jacob Zuma. But then it actually morphed up into now looting and riots that were actually, economically motivated. You had a situation whereby we saw a lot of people take to the streets, robbing and looting shops and stealing goods in public shops and everything. And then it's an indication of the socioeconomic deeper issues that South Africa is faced with, where poverty is at its highest. You've got over 75% of the youth population currently unemployed. You've got the majority of really the adult really in South Africa, about 50% of them, who are currently out of jobs. So there is a huge scale of poverty. I mean, almost 80% of South Africans are currently poor in South Africa. Currently, 34 million people do not have one employment, are living below the breadline in terms of the global standard on breadline, within less than $1, $2 a day. And you have a situation whereby most of the households are child-headed households within the current water camps and environment.
Right. Kofi, your take on that?
It's a combination. It's an explosive, toxic mix, some kind of cocktail of driving forces. And I think they've already mentioned that. But what is so important is that these are not just up in the air. They're evidence-based. The Statistics SA, which is a government outfit, constantly present the narrative of this evidence about what usually the government would call the three big challenges, which I call the three horsemen: poverty, inequality, unemployment. But I've also added more: corruption, crime, and other things like xenophobia that are also playing out in the background. So these are really... this is really the context from which we can start to understand what really happened last week in South Africa.
Prince Ntshabelang, you know, South Africa, many are looking at it that South Africa has experienced protest before. This is not the first such incident, but past incidences of looting have previously been, you know, synonymous with outbreaks of xenophobia. We can go back to 2019 for that one. So what exactly makes this one different from past incidents?
The difference of this one is the mass-scale looting damage in terms of public and private property, the element of the amount of people actually that came out of the squatter camps. And remember, this was not just a provincial one area where there was a focus. This was a sporadic throughout massive amount of provinces, about 4 to 5 provinces really witnessed a similar incident in this case. Whereas in the past, you would have a situation like this where you would have maybe 1 or 2 provinces, Gauteng or KwaZulu-Natal, being the one that is badly affected in terms of the xenophobia or the service delivery, you know, protests and everything. But in terms of the grand scale on public property, public and private property, you know, damage as well as the attacks and people looting and taking for themselves, what they felt is due to them. And remember, this is coming out of another situation whereby South Africa has never went through a process whereby there was a redress of the apartheid system, where there was equity in terms of distribution of wealth, people being given opportunities. And not only that, the fact that there was never reparations. So you found a situation where people took the law into their own hands and said, this is our own form of reparations. When they were taking, you know, manufacturers, you know, retailers, they were going after shops and everything, and taking private goods onto their own possessions and claiming it to be theirs because they feel that they never got anything out of apartheid.
Right. Tembisa, did the scale of the looting, you know, and the outburst from South Africa, did that come as a surprise to you, though?
Well, it didn't come as a surprise to me because we need to remember certain things. One, there was an element of thuggery in this entire process of looting. And the second point is that the people who were protesting under the banner of freeing the former president, Jacob Zuma, from jail, were basically defending lawlessness, because Jacob Zuma defied the court order to go and appear at a commission which was instituted by, amongst others, him, to try and come up with a redress of the past corruption in South Africa. So you are talking about people who are basically perpetuating the unruliness and the defiance by the former president, Jacob Zuma. That's the second point. But the other point is, for me, I saw this as the maturing of democracy. We have seen throughout the world, whenever there are protests or riots, people do loot. It happens, and it happened in the United States, and it happened in other parts of Europe. So I think it was it's part of that maturing of democracy, and South Africa is a democratic country, and people have the right to protest. I'm not encouraging looting, but the fact that you have people who will go out and protest and express their views, that has to be encouraged. What must not be encouraged is thuggery, and it's the looting that we've seen last week, mainly encouraged by the so-called pro-Zuma campaign.
Right. Let me get your thoughts here, Kofi, though, because when you look at that, you know, the scale of the protests, the looting and the burning, would you say, you know, as Tembisa has put it, that is a sign of a maturing democracy?
I would be a bit careful on connecting that with democracy, especially in the wanton nature. So to answer your question that you asked earlier, what makes it so unique? There are four things for me. The first one, I would agree with Crown Prince and Ntshabelang, the scale, but also sort of deliberate localized in two provinces. And then the other one is the nature of the violence, the sort of cruelty, wanton destruction, everything that went on. But the third one, added to the violence, is the speed at which it took place so fast in time that the police and the army couldn't even react and then deal with it. And of course, the last one for me that makes it also unique is a seemingly deliberate, I wouldn't say planning, but also sudden organized small groups with nobody at the head who managed to attack in a way that really gave the impression that this was sort of planned and organized. So these are the four elements for me
So coming back to democracy, in a democracy and in terms of maturity, I wouldn't use that term to say because they went out, that they were violent, and then they were expressing some kind of maturity. That's a no-no for me. I would disagree with that.
Right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more on what is going on in South Africa. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Talk Africa. Let's continue our discussion. Still with me, Tembisa Fakude, joining us via Zoom from Johannesburg, Crown Prince Adil Chabeleng, and also joining us, Kofi Kwakwau, joining us from Johannesburg, all via Zoom. Prince Chabeleng, I mean, it does seem that the organs of state have come out to try and arrest the situation. But I do want to go back to what the World Bank has said about South Africa, because according to the World Bank, South Africa is one of the world's most unequal countries, with about 20% of the population controlling about 70% of the resources. You would have thought that 27 to 30 years after democracy, there would have been a better access to economic and, you know, and the political sphere. So why hasn't the African National Congress been able to rectify the economic situation?
The current impasse in South Africa economically is the fact that we inherited after the democracy a set of agreements which were made actually pre the democratic dispensation, which said that, one, the retention of the wealth in South Africa in terms of mineral resources, the control of the economy, the major capital sitting at the South African Stock Exchange was actually going to remain in the old apartheid companies as well as individuals who enjoyed the current capital maneuvering of the past. So when Black people took over, when the ANC took over power, they never focused at all in terms of the economic issues and the financial issues and the issues with regards to capital. And we actually liberalized our economy, whereby we allowed a lot of capital flights, where the rules were liberalized for capital to fly out. So the current situation you see, where 80% of South Africa's population is living in poverty, less than really about 1% of actually South Africa, 10% of the current middle class is actually living on living wage, which is really survival, substantial income. The majority of the wealth is concentrated in few families, not even massive hundreds of families, just a few families that have enjoyed the historical, which is apartheid colonial, including the current new democratic dispensation in terms of wealth accumulation and enjoying the aspect of wealth in the South African context. So the poverty you see is systematic. It was created within the institutions of democracy, and there was never a redress of creating an economy which would serve the people. The concentration in terms of the power and the control of the South African Reserve Bank itself does not provide wealth, does not provide income, does not provide any aspect of relief with regards to ensuring that South Africa can grow as an economy. Their focus has just been on making sure that the rand actually can be kept stable and there is no inflation in the economy. And that's not really a function of a Reserve Bank. Reserve Bank is supposed to be creating income, creating wealth, creating jobs, ensuring that the economy is surviving,
right,
and injecting required income into the economy whenever needed in order to boost and bolster growth. But that doesn't happen within the South African context. That's why we have a majority of the population currently poor. Those that have not made wealth out of really taking charge or taking advantage of government tenders are left out in the open, especially Black majority in South Africa.
Right. Tembisa, what extent, though, do you still feel that apartheid has affected the current situation?
Well, indeed, apartheid has impacted on what's going on. There's a high level of poverty, as Adil alluded, and the level of inequality remains problematic. But there are projects and systems in place that are attempting or trying to redress and push back those challenges that we continue to see as a result of apartheid. The fact that three of us, I assume all blacks sitting here speaking in English, that in itself is a step forward. It was something unheard of before. We've had an economy, whether we like it or not, a growing black middle class. And again, there's political emancipation. We might not take that for granted. Yes, I do agree that economic power is key and essential, but at the same time, political emancipation for some of us was a priority, and we do have that. Yes, there are still two different economies in South Africa, one for the rich and one for the poor, but the current government, you know, at the risk of sounding as if I'm trying to defend the failures and the successes of the ruling or the governing party, they have done well in terms of bringing certain services to the previously disadvantaged communities in South Africa, particularly the black rural communities in South Africa.
Kofi, do you feel that progress has been too slow, or you know, are there too many unfulfilled expectations following the end of the apartheid in 1994?
Both. I would say both. I think we should also put a bit of focus on the role of the states, the government. What is it doing? If we do a short, even a brief assessment on looking at addressing problems of South Africa, short and long term, there have been a great deal of work done, especially under the Mbeki government, on scenario planning and so forth. All these plans have come to a halt. And literally one of the reasons most of these haven't panned out is the fragility of the state, its role to deliver, to have leaders who have the conscience of taking the country where it should be going. And that fragility start first in the successive government led by the African National Congress. There's a great deal of fragmentation within the African National Congress. I would even go further to say almost a bloated government, lists of people who have not really executed what their president has asked them to do. I can't remember the number of ministers now, probably 40 if you include the deputy ministers. And that's a large crowd of people who should be able to deal with all these issues. And one of the lessons we've learned, especially the past four decades with China, is if you have a great, solid, stable state,
right,
and competent state, you're most likely to execute and to do well. Now, I know a lot of capitalists don't like to hear that, but the role of the state is essential in leading the country with foresight, with insight, and also delivery. So that role needs to be put on the burner, needs to be discussed. I mean, if you take the government of President Cyril Ramaphosa today, there's a deputy president is out of the country, is a minister of health is now acting, it's not even acting, it's just put on leave.
Right.
And so there are all these elements that fragilize the strength of the state. And until those have been addressed, South Africa is still going to be in a very difficult position to deal with these short and long-term problems.
Prince Ntshabelang, you know, to most of us across the continent, the events in South Africa have been quite unsettling because South Africa is Africa's most advanced economy and clearly one of its richest. What do you think needs to change now? What lessons can other African countries learn from the situation in South Africa?
In terms of South Africa being a model for African countries, most definitely. I mean, you know, we have an institutions that have survived the, you know, post-apartheid era that were actually improved upon within the current new dispensation. But what is currently happening is South Africa is actually downgrading rather than actually upgrading towards becoming a highly efficient, highly, you know, institutionalized, you know, country and a democracy as it's supposed to be. I mean, you can't come from the highest and then you start downgrading or even actually losing your level of momentum. What has happened is, I travel throughout Africa. I've been throughout Kenya. I've been throughout many other countries in Africa. What I'm seeing is what other African countries have gone through. Inherited institutions that were previously colonial, whether it was apartheid at the time or colonial, they inherited those institutions which were highly efficiently run and were actually positioned to grow economies as well as countries. But what when the black leadership across the African continent, by the way, when they come in, instead of focusing on growing those economies, growing their countries, actually focusing on bettering their people, their nation, and putting their nation at heart, it doesn't happen. African leaders become dictators. They take on the wealth of the state and they personalize it into their own purses. And not only that, they then downgrade those particular institutions to serve their own particular needs. This has happened throughout all of Africa. That is why we have now the scaling down or even the breaking down of infrastructure development in South Africa, the really servicing of infrastructure. You're no longer having a rapid growth and development as it was actually pretext before when we had the reconstruction and development program where roads were built and everything. Today, we're actually scaling down on all the programs, healthcare, education, infrastructure, public institutions, where we're looking at everything is scaling down. The government is proposing to be cutting over 30% to 40% of its employees.
Right.
You know, you're looking at the technology taking over. So there hasn't been, you know, I mean, I would like to agree with my colleagues on the panel to say there is improvement. Yes, there was cosmetic improvement over the period. You know, Fakuri is right that, you know, democracy is plagued by challenges. But on the side of it is where I say very clearly and strongly is whenever there's no checks and balances, where leaders are given a de facto rulership where they can become de facto, really dictators in a way, where they get their way and they use the power that they have to fight against their opponents politically. This is what we're experiencing. South Africa is no longer discussing development.
Right.
We're discussing political maneuvering and meandering.
Kofi, you have the final word here.
Yes. For me, the cost of this last week violent riots will be very huge. We don't even know yet how big they will be. So in short, for the short and long-term solutions to these challenges, I would suggest to look into three things very seriously. The first one is a responsible, accountable, and capable state where there are competent people to run the country. That's one. The second is to deal with the monster of corruption that's now plaguing any delivery that's going on in the country. And the third is to put a serious focus on what is usually called the inclusive economy so that it's broad enough with entrepreneurs and small and medium-sized enterprises and then entrepreneurs to be able to come out of this crisis. And I think if these three areas are dealt with, there may be others, of course, the moral issues, but I see these three as a key big building blocks to deal with the future of South Africa.
Gentlemen, very interesting discussion indeed, but that's all we have time for on this edition of Talk Africa. A big thank you to our panel of experts, Tembisa Fakude, Senior Research Fellow and Director at the Africa-Asia Dialogue, Crown Prince Adil Nchebeleng, a Royal Prince of the Royal Rau Nchebeleng Tribal Authority in Limpopo, South Africa, and Mr. Kofi Kwaukau, the Africa Analyst and Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. Remember, you can be a part of this conversation online through Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and do join us again next week for more of Talk Africa. I'm Beatrice Marshall. Until next time, goodbye.
Welcome back, and that was CGTN, Africa Live, with a discussion from various perspectives on the current situation in the Republic of South Africa, considering the unrest and political instability. And this is the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. We'll listen to excerpt of our next segment from CGTN as well. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Monsoon brings heavy rains and strong winds to parts of Asia. Africa CDC warns that Algeria and Tunisia are experiencing a fourth wave of COVID infections. And Japanese authorities deport a Ugandan weightlifter who went missing. Hello and welcome to Africa Live. As always, great to have you with us. I'm Richard Ntah, live in Nairobi. And for those of you joining us from across the continent and around the globe, we thank you for joining us. Let's take a look at other stories making headlines this hour. Tanzania plans to vaccinate 60% of its population. And South Africa begins vaccinating prisoners. Once again, welcome to Africa Live. So good to have you with us. Let's begin in parts of Asia where the continent has been battered by strong winds and heavy monsoon rains. They've triggered floods and landslides in China, India, and the Philippines. In central China's Henan province, authorities say the death toll has risen to 58. Five people are reported missing as of 4 p.m. Saturday. Officials say rescue efforts continue for those trapped by the rains and floods. In central China's Xinjiang City, rescuers and residents across the city have been racing to build a sandbag wall to block further overflow from the river. Over 1.7 million people have been affected by record floods and downpours. Intense storms dumped a year's worth of rain on the area in just days, inundating about 120 counties. Although the rain has stopped, waterlogging and swelling rivers remain a threat. Sin Zhuan reports from Xinjiang.
You can hear it's very noisy here. So I'm actually in the city of Xinjiang. I was hit over by some of the rescue workers just a minute ago. Well, where I'm standing now is actually on the main street of the Xinjiang Avenue. So this is the main street in the city of Xinjiang. And you can see people are working behind me around the clock to transfer sandbag. The reason why this is happening is because overflow happened on the external canal and then it poured into the internal channel to deflood the city. So that means there is an overflow on the upstream and causing this flood pouring into the city. And so right there, the People Liberation Army is working around the clock to actually to get the embankment higher. However, 2 days ago when the overflow happened,
and that's all the time we have for today. And that was a report on developments in the People's Republic of China, who is also dealing with flooding, as is the case in the United States, as well as Europe. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July 24th, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you want to have access to our program, just log on to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with Hank Mobley and another workout. Have a beautiful week. The top of 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 the top of
Thank you.